This episode was originally a live conversation which took place at the CEF Founders Conference in 2023.
For each round, the investors want 20 to 30% of your company. So what you really need to do as a startup founder, so you should just first think, how much money do you really need to deliver which type of milestones? Are they meaningful? Are these milestones going to bring you to a higher valuation in the next run? Then you back calculate how much, you know, is the valuation in the end.
Welcome to the Swisspreneur Show, a podcast about startup stories and learnings from experienced entrepreneurs. Here's your host, Sylvan.
We have three guests lined up for you. I'm going to introduce them one by one. The first guest that we have on the panel is Sophie Lamparter. She is the founder and managing partner of Dart Labs. They are based in Zurich and San Francisco. And they basically bridge the gap between Europe, where they invest, and help these startups that they invest in to accelerate on the US market. A very well welcome, Sophie. Thank you for joining. Our second guest, yes, please. Our second guest is one of the most active angel investors here in Switzerland. He has invested in companies like Facebook, Mobileye, or SumUp, just to name a few. And he's on the hunt for Zunicorns, companies that hopefully soon turn into unicorn, $1 billion plus valuations. Please welcome Daniel Gutenberg. And last but not least, we have Christina Wallgren, the co-founder and CEO of Therapet, a Geneva-based next-gen imaging company that is also joining us here on the panel. Before that, she was a staff physicist at the CERN, and she holds a PhD in applied physics as well as an MBA. Thank you for joining us, Christina. Sophie, let me just get started with you. You bridge the gap between Europe and the United States. What are the biggest differences between these two ecosystems?
I mean, it's Europe and US is pretty big. So what I can talk about more is maybe specifically Switzerland and Silicon Valley. I think we can't, the US as one is a challenge, right? But California definitely has some unique parts. I could answer this question many different ways. I think for me, the biggest difference is actually the culture. Mm-hmm. I mean, of course, it's size and speed and all these things, but I think it's the culture. And you can see that in every interaction you have with people living in California with a Californian mindset. I always say to compare, like, you start the conversation in California always with a yes. Like, yes, why not? Yes, this sounds possible. And then you figure out as you go if it stays a yes or it might turn into a no. This could be in a private relationship. This could be a business. This could be value fundraising. Yeah. In Switzerland, it's rather the opposite. You often start with a no, and it takes some time. You have to build trust first. It takes a couple of meetings. They get to know you. And maybe if things go well, you can end up with a yes. The other path, I think, is much more open to, of course, innovation, big thinking, starting new things. So for a startup ecosystem, this is the more preferred type of culture. And I think I see more and more Switzerland adapting to that. But I think we could push a little more because we have so much to offer. There's great talent, fantastic universities. There are wonderful companies that are built here. We should just say yes more often.
Sounds like a lot of untapped potential still here.
Absolutely. I mean, that's why we started Dart, exactly, to build that bridge and give this yes possibilities to a lot of the Swiss founders.
That brings me to you, Daniel. How many of the companies that you have invested in that are unicorns now are actually Swiss companies?
Well, first, thank you very much for inviting me to come here. It's an incredible place and an incredible room. I'm really on the floor. None of my unicorns are based in Switzerland so far. Maybe a few Zunicorns. There will be unicorns soon are Swiss-based. I'm chasing my startups globally, which for me means the US, Europe, Brazil, and Israel. Mm-hmm. And so far, I was luckier, or it has developed faster in some other countries.
Based on your experience, what do we need to hopefully have more unicorn companies here in Switzerland?
Well, first of all, I don't know if that's the goal. I mean, like we heard this morning from Liz Truss and from Peter Spuhler especially, we have other characteristics in Switzerland that make us what we are, and maybe it's not our goal to be, you know, Elon Musk-style entrepreneurs. But for sure, to make a unicorn, you need to have, you need to be able to take a lot of risks. And just 5 minutes ago, Alain Berset got a Rubik's Cube, a deck of cards, and some dice. And the question was, which is more, which of those things do you use most, which would you use to show that you're taking risks? Or what would you play in the casino? So maybe that's what we need to do. A little bit more risk, a little bit more out of the window.
Nice. And Christina, we heard before in the intro, you hold a PhD in physics, but also an MBA, so more the business side. What made you to combine these two disciplines altogether?
Yeah, first of all, thanks for the invitation. It's great to be here. And it's nice to be in one of the panelists here. So. Yeah, physics and MBA. I started my MBA program was while I was still working at CERN. So it was I started in 2012 while I was when my first son was born. So I was on maternity leave. So then because the baby is extremely kind, I slept a lot during the day. So I decided, yeah, why not? I think I felt at that time I had enough time to do something new. Then I decided to take the challenge, which is a big challenge, in fact. Later, I realized it. But at that time, I had no idea that one day I would become a startup founder. So it's just something that I knew that I didn't want to do research for the rest of my life. Why not to learn some new fundamentals in business and like economics? So I started the MBA program. So later on, I do realize that I think being a founder as well as being a CEO for an extremely innovative medtech startup, in order to be good at what you are doing technically and also understand the basics behind the business and the economics, I think it's almost a necessity. So I don't think doing a PhD or doing an MBA is a must for being a startup founder. But understand the common sense in business and the economics, I think it's almost a must, at least in this stage for a company like ours. So that's
they go hand in
started.
Hand.
Yeah. Exactly. Without one or the other, I think it would be extremely challenging, at least for a company like ours. So we are a high-tech medical device company. So.
I do want to talk about funding and financing today with all three of you. And Sophie, let me start with you. How does the current investor climate look like, or the funding climate out there?
It's difficult. Yeah, and I can assure founders that are fundraising out here, it's also difficult for investors, right? You sometimes forget that VCs are also raising money, right? We are in the process of raising right now, and it used to be easier, for sure. So I think, like, whenever there is volatility, uncertainty, people reduce their risk appetite. And we do need, like you were saying, we do need people to take risks, right? On the founder side, as well as on the investor side. And that's the current challenge.
If even the investor says, oh, it's difficult at the moment, I'm really curious to hear the startup founder's perspective. How does it look like for you,
yeah,
Christina?
Yeah, I confirm what Sophie just said. It's very difficult. I think, as I remember, we did our seed run in 2020. So it's in the middle of the COVID. So it took 3 weeks to close our seed round of 1 million. But okay, obviously seed and Series A, they are different. But now it takes a significantly much longer time. You need to talk to many, many different investors. Most of the time you get a no, just even without have a more in-depth meeting. So that's a bit sad, because you have not even get a chance to present what you can offer. So, but I think this is what happens today. But I still believe that the good business with a good product market fit and strong leadership will always raise fund, regardless the hard time. I think there's still a lot of dry powders waiting to be deployed. So I hope that more and more investors will be able to see the potential, especially in business with more tangible products, mm-hmm. so that they are more willing to invest.
So the climate is difficult, Daniel. From your perspective and your experience, is there any such a thing as the right timing for a startup to go out there and try to raise funds?
Well, let me come back first to the question, the climate is difficult. I think next year we're going to be looking at 2023 and saying, oh, 2023 was easy, actually, in comparison, because I don't think there's a way that we're going by without a recession that is coming. So I think for me, 2024, 2025 even are going to be more difficult. Well, the way I see startups, and I totally agree, as a like in the seed rounds, no problem. You will always get money. That's not that's clear when you don't have to, you know, do the valuation game and everything. So you always get money. So as a startup, you're constantly raising. I mean, that's what a CEO of a startup has to do. I mean, it's like from the beginning when you put the idea on the paper, all the way through until you're profitable, I think you'll be constantly raising and spending a considerable amount of your time for the raising. So there's no right timing. It's like all the way through.
It's your job all the time, basically. Yes, Sophie?
And as an investor, now is actually the perfect time to invest, right? Because the companies that are making it now in a more difficult environment are more likely to prove that they can do that, right? Like a year ago or 2 years ago, where money was easy to get, like a lot of ideas got funded that might not actually had the right execution plan and so forth. So I think now you will find the more resilient teams and the right ideas that get funded. So
right,
yeah.
And Christina, you also raised around a seed round.
Yeah, we recently closed our first closing of the pre-series A. We call it pre-series A because apparently the time is getting harder, so the numbers are getting smaller. So it was recently we closed our first closing. The reason that we did that is that just not in order not to sacrifice the business and the product development, so we decided to close the first closing so that we can really dive into the real business. So the first closing was 2.3 million. But of course, we are also extending this pre-series A for another couple of months, just in order to prevent the even harder time to come. So the next year, as you said, maybe even harder. I don't know. So we have already, we extended it to 1.3 million. So already more than 800K is committed. So we have 500K left. Open tickets, anyone who would be interested. So please
always
feel free.
Be selling.
Please feel free to take contact with us. So we're happy to tell you more about the condition.
You decided to go for a traditional funding round. So did you ever consider that, to go for something different than a traditional funding round?
Actually, we didn't only go for a traditional funding round. It's not a by decision, because a company like us, thanks to the degree of the innovation, we have already gained a significant amount of public funds through, thanks to InnoSuite and all Eurostars. We gained quite a lot public funds in the beginning. But obviously, because we are doing a medical device with very complex components, so a company like ours, it's very capital intense. So in order to move the company forward, you need to have a capital. So it's not that by decision that we go for a traditional fundraising. It's just it's the nature of the business, right? So that's what we decided to do.
Makes sense. I also want to get practical, no matter if it's a difficult time or not. So when you actually start to fundraise, what are some documents or KPIs you need to prepare that you as investor, Sophie, want to see?
I mean, yeah, everything about the team, the plan, the technology, I mean, the obvious things. And you want to see a team that is actually prepared for that fundraise, right? That has their things together, that have a plan, a strategy on how to execute that fundraise and on what kind of timeline. I think it's really important that founders know how to also drive their fundraising process, especially in these difficult times, like where investors might take some extra time or want to review this again, and they're just all waiting for the lead investor and the terms to come in. Like, it could drag on and drag on, and you easily spend 6 months or more or a year fundraising. So I think being really prepared and also define the time where you're going to focus on this is really important. There is a really good masterclass on the Swisspreneurs podcast that we once recorded that I'm hearing from a lot of founders that's actually helpful. And there we did like a step plan. And I think it's just good if you as a founder feel in charge of the process rather than the investors. Yeah.
Daniel, you said it's a full-time job, basically, you know, as a founder, to always be fundraising, but you still have to run a business, right? You still have to probably do sales, hire people. How do you make sure that when you're in fundraising mode that you don't neglect your operational business?
Well, I guess that's one of the main capabilities a CEO needs to have. He needs to be able to do multitasking. He needs to be able to delegate. He needs to be able to choose the right people and give them some power. And that's what it's all about, really. And the part of raising is but now there's so many, like you said, there's so many classes, so many places to learn on how to do that. I mean, I've been doing this for way over 20 years, and it used to be very different. It used to be, you know, seed money, A, B, C, and now it's like safe, pre-seed, seed extension, convertible, pre-A. I mean, it's like a whole industry and new of terminology that came out of those schools. And of course, you have no choice. You have to do the same as the others do, and you have to kind of, elbow your way around and make yourself heard.
From an investor perspective, when you look at the startup, is there any minimum runway that the startup still has to have cash in the bank before they can actually go fundraising? Is there any of that thing that you look at in terms of months, maybe?
The smaller the runway, the higher the water, right? So but I think, yeah.
You know, when you look at
the startup,
if you
have less than 6 months, everyone starts getting nervous, right? Yeah. Your team will start getting nervous. The founder, him or herself, the investors look at it and it's like, oops. Like, it gives less room to negotiate. They know you need the money. So, yeah. I mean, ideally, you go into fundraising, you still have 12 months to go, I think, in these days. Yeah.
But maybe if you have a short runway, that's also where great deals happen, Daniel.
for the investor.
So people always forget. I mean, as an investor, after a while, you have a portfolio of companies. I currently have 81 companies, and I think they will have a hard time for the next 2-3 years. And will be relying on me partially, so I need to keep money for them. I want to have, you know, money for my companies going forward. So even if I see good deals out there, I'm just keeping my money and don't do crazy stuff right now. So it's not like the deals are so good and you buy 2 cents on the dollar. That's not my thinking right now. My thinking is really with my portfolio companies, and I want to make sure that they are safe and that they go through it.
Got it. And the big question is also, you both saw a lot of pitch decks. You probably created your own pitch deck, Christina, when you were, raising the round. What makes a good pitch deck? What really stands out when you receive plenty every day? So I first want to hear the investor's perspective and then the founder's perspective. Let's start with you, Sophie. What makes a great pitch deck? What is one thing that gets your attention that stands out?
I mean, I really like to understand the pitch deck, right?
That's a start.
I think.
I agree.
Yeah, and that's something that founders should like take into account. The investors usually are not from your industry, or they don't know much about your technology. So can you create a pitch deck where everyone gets what you're doing on the technology side, on the business side? So I think clarity, simplicity, and some excitement in one deck, that's kind of... And then you can also talk about it, and you can ask questions. If you don't even understand the deck, I usually then put it on the side, right?
Right.
Yeah.
You second that?
Absolutely. Before I was a venture capitalist, I was a distributor, and I used to go to trade shows, Comdex and CeBIT, and I used to walk through the aisles back and forth and to look at every single booth to find the startups I want to work with. Mm-hmm. And if I couldn't understand what they sell while walking through the aisles, I would not consider doing an investment or distributing them. So more less than 30 seconds, I think, when you look at the pitch deck on the first page, maybe at the latest of the second page, you need to know what it's about.
Yeah. Christina, when you were reaching out to investors, how do you go about that? Because finding them is one point, but then also getting in touch with them, getting their attention, that's a whole different level. How do you go about that to find your investors for your company?
I think first thing is that, okay, you need to create that kind of visibility so that people know that you exist and your company exists. Then afterwards, I think it's important, the thing is to, once they know that you are here, then you create attractions so that you're constantly, your company constantly developing, so that they can know that you really deliver what you promise. Mm-hmm. Then they can see that the company is growing by the time. This is one of the best things, that to create a trust. You can say a lot of good things about your company, but of course, obviously, everyone says it. So all the startups say good things about themselves. Important to have a good pitch deck, obviously. We learned it in a hard way, because I remember the true story for us is that the first time we went to VentureKick stage one, I mean, everyone knows about VentureKick, and in fact, we failed. So I was at the VentureKick stage one stage, then they actually kicked out us. They told us, you are not here to give us physics lessons. You are here to present your company. So we did fail, but luckily they were so kind to us. So we went, they invited us back to pitch again. So in the end, we took all the stage, all the three stages, and they got 150 in the end. But then we learned it. The pitch deck must be clear. So you must send the message within 30 minutes, even for the people that are non-physicists, understand what you are really doing. So this is extremely important. I totally agree. Because you receive so many pitch decks every day. If you don't get it from the first seconds, why do you even bother? Exactly. This is also the way that the founders, they need to learn that the message needs to be clear. But obviously, sometimes it can be difficult, like our business, right? But you learn it.
And it's not just about convincing the investors, right? It's sure. Like you're going to have to talk to potential clients. You're going to talk to potential hires. Like, you have to build momentum around your company as a CEO all the time, right? And if you're able to convince people rather quickly about what you're doing and how exciting this is, that the more successful you're going to be, right? So that's something that we think about a lot, right? Like, if I don't get it, how is this person going to hire? How is this person going to find the customers, right?
Yeah. But that seems to be the pitch deck. It's like the first entry gate, right? Then you want to build a momentum. You want to show ideally growth. You want to keep the investors or potential investors updated to really strengthen the relationship, I imagine. Mm-hmm. Daniel, from your perspective, you had a lot of pitch deck. You have an incredible hit rate of uncovering and hitting unicorns. I wonder, from your perspective, from an investor's perspective, what actually makes a successful company? What are the pillars that you look at to evaluate a case?
So, I mean, it's for me, it's 90% the founder, the CEO, and then you know, the other percentage is the market for a big part, and then at the end, the product. And that sounds a bit bizarre, because people always think the product is the most important, but for me that's not true. You can have, you know, the best product in the world with a bad team, it just won't fly. And you can have a really bad product and it will fly perfectly with a good team. I mean, Microsoft is the best, I mean, example of that. I'm not talking about Microsoft today. I'm talking about Microsoft like 25 years ago. They did a really good job. And I see that again and again and again. A good team will be able to, even if they find out that the product wasn't good, to do a pivot or to make the product better. Or I mean, there's many possibilities if you have a good team.
90% is team. How do you evaluate a team? Do you have sort of a gut feeling that tells you thumb up or thumb down? Or how do you do that? Give us the secret sauce.
There is no secret sauce. There's a list of parameters that is 1 mile long. And of course, the more you train on those parameters and the longer you do it, the better you own your senses for it. And sometimes even after 25 years, I'm completely wrong. So there is no magic to it. You just have to compare the cases with each other. So it's a numbers game. I look at more than 1,000 startups every year and make only 5-6 investments. It's also, it's a numbers game at the end of the day.
But do you have a few examples in what you look for in a founder's team? It could be background, could be their characteristics, whatever it is.
Of course, yeah. I look at people who, you know, think, eat, sleep, and do nothing else but solving a problem. I look at people that are, you know, fall in love with the problem and not with the solution. And I think that's the key metric. If you find somebody that you know, very often, I have to say, very often startups fall in love with the solution they have and try to find, you know, places where they can use it instead of the other way around, to see a problem and, you know, fall in love with the problem. And there's a good book with exactly this title from an Israeli writer that I read lately.
Perfect. Let's flip the table. What are you looking for, Christina, in an investor, despite the money, of course, but what are you looking for in investors to partner up with them?
I think it's important to find the right investor for your startup. So there's never a good or a bad one. So it's just only a suitable one for you. So I think the chemistry is extremely important. So it's like, because you partner with the investor in the long run, especially in medical device companies, so from the path from the idea to the product is extremely long. So the founders need to be resilient, the investors is supportive and really like a patient. So you need to have a right chemistry from the start. If it feels wrong from the start, it's probably wrong. So it's a bit like a marriage in a long term. So it's important, chemistry need to be right. But obviously investors have so many deals and the startups, there are so many. So it's not always right for a young startup to find the perfect investors. Or I mean, it's hardworking. So you need to reach out as much as you can. And the important thing, as mentioned before, traction to create the dynamic during the fundraising as well. Well, what do they normally say? You have to kiss thousands of frogs to find the prince, right? You have to reach out. I think that's one of the things, because the time is different. Before, like, we get emails, investors come to us and ask, do you want investment? But these days, I think the dynamic is a bit changed. As you said, you also want to, prioritize your own startups in the first priority, right? So the new investment is a bit more like second priority if there's a good deal out there, obviously.
So we heard about the matchmaking sort of between the founders and the investors. One thing that they have to agree on is the valuation. Is that more art or science, Sophie?
I mean, we work in very early stage, yeah. Pre-seed and seed. There, I think it's almost given, right? Because it's like depending on is it how much technology is there, is it university spin-off or is it revenue-based? So I think there is not that big of a range. Then I think later it becomes more of a science with numbers. But at the beginning, it's kind of, I don't know if you could call it art, but it's some sort of common agreement, right? Like a good investor tries to find something that makes sense for the company as well as the investors, right? It doesn't make sense if the founder is diluted too much. It doesn't make sense for their growth. It doesn't make sense if they have too much and the investors don't, like, if the valuation is already too high, it might be harder to hire further. So there is like kind of a good sweet spot, and ideally it's kind of a comfortable negotiation with the investors. Yeah.
What does that mean in terms of a range? How much percentage should you give up at an early stage, or what's the range of the valuation you should aim for?
So every round we say, like, there's just a sum round at the beginning, 20 to 25% would be the max, right? Because you're going to have potentially a few more rounds, especially like a company that is still doing medical devices, for example, right? So yeah, we're quite careful with that. Like, we don't want that founders get too diluted, because you want them to be incentivized to keep building these companies, right? So yeah, there is not too high, not too low. I think there is, yeah, maybe you call it an art. Yeah.
Fair point.
Yeah.
But for you, Daniel, as an investor, you of course also want to make a sweet return if the plan works out, right?
Absolutely. So, absolutely. I really don't think it's an art. I really think it's science, but it's a fluctuating science.
Okay.
So, I mean, of course, the prices today are not the same as they were like a year or 2 years ago. And then again, it's not only about valuation. I mean, don't forget the terms are super important. I mean, they play, I mean, you know, the number of the valuation says absolutely nothing if the terms are not plain vanilla, which they quite often are not. Nowadays, especially. There, you know, the advantage is, I think also startups need to do the same game. They also need to do a numbers game. They also need to talk to a lot of investors to get a feel for it. If you need five investors and you just talk to 10, then you're never gonna know what's happening. So you need to really have a very large amount of investors that you talk to.
It's like a sales funnel, right? When you're selling your product, you probably also need a sweet funnel to acquire some customers. You mentioned these important terms besides the valuation part. Maybe we can just highlight a few key items there for people to really pay attention to those.
So there's this thing called lick pref, which means that if there's a down round or if there is a sale below the price I invested in, I get a preference, so I get my money back first, or sometimes there's a double or three times lick pref, so I get three times my money back, and then the other guys get their money back. So if somebody wants to offer me those terms, I hate it, but if they do, I'm ready to pay a higher valuation. And that's basically only because for some reason, sometimes it's only for visibility. Startups want to have higher valuations. I really don't like it, I have to say. And there's a whole amount of terms that go in the similar direction.
Christina, how was that from your side? You know, when you met the investors, did you come up with a valuation first, or did you sort of wait them to value your business? How did that go down?
I think the valuation it's more like you have a different methods, as you already mentioned, to calculate the valuation. But in the end, it's more like an indication rather than an outcome. So a comparison between a similar startup at a similar stage is quite a good start point. But in the end, I do have a feeling whatever investment amount you're asking, the investors always want to have at least 20 to 30% of your companies.
Not true.
Not true. Okay.
Maybe my feeling is true. I never want to have more than one digit.
Okay. Yeah. But not a single investor. I mean, that's
all the investors.
Yeah,
together.
All them. That's what I mean for each run. So that's for each run, the investors want 20 to 30% of your company. So what you really need to do as a startup founder, so you should just first think how much money do you really need to deliver which type of milestones. Are they meaningful? Are these milestones going to bring you to a higher valuation in the next run? Then you back calculate how much, you know, is the valuation in the end. Then, of course, during negotiation, investors always want to push down a bit. Okay, be prepared for that. Then, obviously, in the end, valuation is just a number. It's not the single term that in the term sheet you need to be really worried about. More terms that is more even the other factors are even more important than single valuation. Because in the end, I mean, maybe your goal in the future is to sell your company or whatever. I mean, the final goal is there, right? So the way taking there, I think, yeah, if you need capital to bring you to the next step, I think as a founder, to have a certain motivation from the start until a certain level, a certain stage, I think it's important, meaning that holding enough shares until that moment, I think it's important even for the company, because the company needs to have the foundation soul in it in order to bring to the next level.
So I like what you said about the milestones. I think your fundraising story, yeah, to build it up around the milestones, exactly, as inflection points, that's key. Yeah. Not only to the round that you're raising, but also for future rounds to,
exactly,
deliver and build trust in the end, basically.
Yeah.
One last question for Daniel. Once you invested in a company, do you think that investors should go and sit on the board of the company?
I know why you're asking that. I don't like to sit on the boards. I think they're pretty boring meetings, and I'm an engineer, and I'm not a finance guy. So for me, it doesn't make sense much to sit on the boards. I do if I have to, and I do sit on a few boards. I'm looking for unicorns. I have myself never built a unicorn, so I'm only investing in people that are much more intelligent than me. So why would they need somebody like me on the board? Doesn't make any sense, right? So I from my side, I'd rather not be on the board, really.
Got it. How is that for you, Sophie?
We're not on the board either. Yeah. I mean, in a pre-seed company, we believe it's better to be without the board, right? Like, keep it really lean and fast. And then we also have this double role of investors and being accelerator. So we're also partly part of the team, or mm-hmm, let's say the extended team. So adding the governance to it, I would be too much. Yeah, and I agree with you. I think there should be people on the board who can actually add value. We don't really like boards where it's just investors. Like, it's so much better if there is actually somebody who has built a similar company before or brings specific industry knowledge. Yeah.
Sounds
but
very reasonable.
Never say no, but for now.
Sure.
Yeah.
We do have time for two questions from the audience. Oh, we already have the first one right there.
Thank you. Doram Kuma from Lunea. We are in the life science. I would like to have a precision from Sophie and from Daniel. Why do you think that the Swiss startup scene means the entrepreneur are not taking the same risk as the other in the States? I spent my career 18 years building a company which we bought public, a startup. At the SIX and NASDAQ. I do acquisition and partnership and investment in startup. I saw exactly the same risk in Switzerland, in Europe, in the States. Why do you think we don't take the same risk as the US? I will start a venture 2 years ago, Lunea. With agreement of my wife, we put all our fortune in this venture, as many of the startups which are here, which are putting their fortune in the startup. So what is the difference? I want to understand what is the difference from your perspective.
So, by the way, I think the US has the exact same problem as Switzerland nowadays. The difference really is that you have large companies, UBS, Credit Suisse, Novartis, that is hiring the best people, give them huge salaries, nice cars, and those guys have no incentive to... And in the Silicon Valley, I see the same thing. That's why I'm not going to the Silicon Valley that much anymore. The Googles and Facebooks of this world are hiring the best people, and for them there is no incentive to do a startup or to take the risk and eat potatoes for 2 years just to be able to found that. And I find, like, you know, my good unicorns right now, I find them in places like Brazil or Israel, where you don't have those alternatives and where people go all in because they know there's no alternative. I mean, I have to go for low salary anyway, I might as well eat potatoes for 3 years.
But then eventually they probably have to go to the US market, right? As a company itself. I think that's an interesting take to sort of say, hey, the founders come from outside the US,
yeah,
but they want to tackle the US market because it's so big and so attractive.
Absolutely, yeah. And very often you don't even have to physically go there anymore to do business there.
Yeah. Anything you want to add, Sophie?
Yeah, I mean, you asked us about the kind of risk profile. I think there's also has a lot to do with having watched many startups going really successful and having friends who've done it or have invested in one that, you know, Daniel knows that investing in startups is really lucrative, right? But from the outside, I think a lot of the Swiss traditional investors who are not doing venture, they still think, oh, 9 of 10 companies are going to fail. That's really high risk. They don't know any friends who made money with startups, or they don't know enough examples. And I think now Switzerland is really catching up, right? We have a few unicorns now. We have a few companies that are getting larger. And so it's similar to, I don't know, when you see in Israel or here in Silicon Valley, like you have friends who have, you know, made millions because they joined the startup early. You have friends who invested at the right time, who were very successful. So the more, you know, role models you have of successful stories, either founders or investors, the more I think people will say, oh, yes, there is some risk to it, but the potential opportunity is really large, right? So, yeah, I think we just need to keep moving in the direction we are. Yeah.
Nice. We have time for one last question, if there's any. Okay. Oh, right there in the back. Yes.
Hello, everybody. Thank you so much for the discussion. I'm interested how many female founders you have in your 81 portfolio, for example, or overall. Is there like an increase over the years, or is it still like something we're missing?
No, it definitely has increased over the years. I don't know the number by heart. You can look on my webpage and you will see all the companies. But it has definitely increased, and there's some, and I have to say the quality, it's not only about the quantity, but the quality of the female founders I have in my portfolio is really, really good.
Yeah, we have a lot of female founders. Ariana and I started Dart together, so we're two females already. So we have a lot more women, I think, approaching us in the first place. Then I think we look at it a little slightly different, right? We, you know, sometimes do femtech investments because we understand the needs for it. So we have, I think, a third female CEOs and half of them mixed teams. But yeah, I agree with you. Like often when we hear a woman pitch, you're like, actually, wait, maybe she is kind of underselling what they've built already. And we usually rather motivate them to, like, you know, be a bit more ambitious. I think, I don't want to stereotype too much, but I think when a woman is good, she's actually excellent, right? So,
yeah. Absolutely agree.
I think that will make a fantastic topic maybe for next year's panel. Yeah, who knows? Yeah. Christina, Daniel, Sophie, thank you so much for joining us here. All the best and a big round of applause to you.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed today's episode. If you did, you can support us by rating our show on Apple Podcasts. This way, we can reach an ever-growing number of aspiring entrepreneurs.